artists in Europe are open to many stimuli, jazz was one more possibility they could explore, adapt, and use in their own musical creations. Two music theater works confronted the significance of jazz by featuring that musical idiom combined with European styles. Hans Krenek's opera, Johnny Spielau, premiered in Leipzig in 1927, and Imre Kalman's operetta, Die Herzogin von Chicago, premiered in Vienna the following year. Both these works were later banned by the Nazis as indigenous music. While Johnny Spielau takes an earnest tone, Die Herzogin von Chicago approaches jazz in a more lighthearted spirit. As Kevin Clark has pointed out, instead of representing a conflict between musicians, it shows one between consumers of music. We see a Europe whose tastes are changing, adopting the musical preferences of an American slapper, who's an heiress to a large fortune made from sausages in the great city of Chicago. On the other side of the musical divide, preferring old traditions, stands a European prince, heir to a small kingdom that is teetering on the verge of financial ruin. Regardless of his finances, the prince is confident in his aristocratic taste, and the arrogance of blue blood is pitted against that of new money. Behind this musical dispute lie deeper issues, the American appropriation of European culture and the introduction of American art forms to Europe, mixed European responses to jazz, and the European respect for tradition and hierarchy as opposed to the American worldview emphasizing money and business. Today I will discuss the 2004 adaptation of this work at the Vienna Volksoper and its reception. Was it perceived purely as entertainment, or were its jabs at American culture appreciated anew in the context of early 21st century political situations? My comments are based in part on a series of interviews I conducted in 2009, some of those involved in the Herzogin production and others with Austrian intellectuals. We can get a taste of the American-European conflict in the show from its most exciting scene, which takes place in the fictional Grill American restaurant right here in Budapest. Here the two central characters, Miss Mary Lloyd of Chicago and Prince Chandra Boris of Silvaria, encounter each other for the first time.
Thank you.
instantly shows us deeper issues at work. Mary and the prince are equally matched in their pride and arrogance, but she wins the immediate battle through the power of her greater wealth, while he ruefully acknowledges that the power of his blood is dwindling as the family fortune declines. She loves jazz for its energetic dances. He despises it for its African roots. America threatens European tradition because it is an emblem of the shift of power to those who govern the world of commerce. Elsewhere in the operetta, further images of America join business in jazz. Although all are oversimplified stereotypes, and thus we find a link to some of the talks from yesterday, the concept of stereotyping, this collection of images invokes various elements of American culture, presenting a complex picture of American life that includes the love of business and money, modernity as expressed in new cityscapes, art forms including jazz music, jazz dance, and film, African-American culture partly mixed and confused with African culture and thus viewed as primitive, and even folkloric archetypes of cowboys and Indians. Any of these may attract some of the European characters while it antagonizes others. For example, when Mary's private secretary, Bondy, proposes marriage to Princess Rosemarie, he invites her to live with him in his little skyscraper, only 52 stories. But while modernity appeals to the princess, who loves the idea that from the top story they would be able to hear the angels jazz band in heaven, her royal cousin much prefers the Wild West. Attitudes toward jazz are also mixed. This new kind of music has become a fashion in Budapest, but the prince disparages it as a disgusting African dance. His hostility to American money and power is oddly combined with his fear of dark skin and primitive culture. Jazz was not purely African. It had been strongly influenced and mediated by American musical traditions. However, some jazz performers in Europe, such as Josephine Baker in her Banana Skirt, played with this confusion in order to attract audiences, and thus the prince's misinformed view is somewhat understandable. I originally supposed that the 2004 production had been intended as a commentary on current politics, but this turned out not to be true. Rather, the production team had chosen the work both to acknowledge the recent 50-year anniversary of Collins' death in 1953, and as part of a series of works banned by the Nazis. As some of my interviewees suggested, its novelty and long time off the stage, where it hadn't been produced in Vienna since the premiere year in 1928, that this may have led some listeners to experience it in relation to Nazism and the unresolved issues of the 30s and 40s. Adding an interesting twist to the story, the city of Chicago had entered into the Viennese public discourse a few years earlier, first in 1991, then again in 1996. The far-right FPÖ party had used the following slogan in its Vienna elections: Vienna must not become Chicago. This warning, based presumably on the old image of Chicago as a haven of organized crime, led then-Chicago Mayor Richard M. Daley to lodge a formal protest. In 2005, just months after the Herzogin premiere, that slogan was revised, displacing Chicago in favor of another city. Here, the FPÖ was emphasizing the fear of immigrants rather than crime, since I think we can safely state that there are many more Turks than Chicagoans residing in Vienna. That dynamic of repulsion and attraction between Vienna and Chicago provides an interesting counter-melody to the central issues expressed by the show. So moving on to theater and politics, this slide shows the list of people that I interviewed. And some of the interviews were in German and others in English, but I'll give all quotations in English. Despite this quotation in the View in the Salzburger Nachrichten in 2004, my interviews made clear that this show was not selected because of contemporary political issues. Nevertheless, audiences may have interpreted the work with current politics in mind. I questioned my interviewees about Austrian views of America in the early 2000s, and about how Austrians tend to experience theater. They broadly agreed that the Bush administration aroused much anger among educated Austrians. Here are four statements demonstrating that. Number one, it was viewed very simply the business interests that the USA has in Iraq. It's about oil, and it was simply the opinion that the situation in Iraq got worse through the American invasion. That made a very negative image of the USA. And if they wanted to take out Saddam Hussein, there would have been other ways, because, I mean, the CIA isn't stupid, is it? Quote number two. After it became clear that all the arguments for the Iraq War had been constructed were pure fiction, At that time, nobody considering himself or herself an intellectual here would have any positive statements about the U.S. government. Europeans thought, towards the end, people were thinking, Bush really is catastrophic. Number three, and it was very hard for us to understand the political direction that was being taken by the Bush administration, and the year 2004 was important, of course, because of the election. It was the general opinion here in Austria that that election would mean the end of Bush's term as president. Once he was re-elected, there was a good deal of shock, surprise, and disappointment at the continuation of that, and the sense that we were in for four more years of a great deal of political difficulty. And number four, the whole time really up to Obama's election, opinion was negative. It wasn't just about the war. For many intellectuals, it had to do above all with not signing the Kyoto Protocol. The environmentalists saw that especially as a crime, and that was the general opinion. So from my interviews, it also became clear that the Austrian audiences do link theater to contemporary political issues. One person described attending an Ibsen play in which the word Freiheit was used, and this is the word abbreviated by F in the FPÖ party. And as he said, they changed, I think, one word in that line to make it as if it were out of the playbook from today. This was in the 1990s. And the audience reacted immediately. I mean, there were boos, and there was clapping, and there was just immediate tension in the audience, which shows, A, the kind of attention that Austrian audiences give to their pieces, and B, the proximity to political awareness. Another interviewee commented that, quote, every artwork is many-leveled, and is heard, seen, and read differently by different people. Thus, the show's popularity, which I will discuss shortly, probably reflects its appeal to different groups. While some recall the 30s and 40s, others like it read it as a critique of U.S. foreign policy, and a third group probably enjoyed it purely for the spectacle and the exciting mix of sounds and styles. One problem in interpreting the work as a cultural critique is its harmonious resolution. By the end, the prince and the flapper are reconciled, about to be married, and best of all, each one has learned to dance the other one's favorite dance, with the prince declaring that the Charleston is just the American charge. The conventional ending, however, does not erase the questions raised in the middle, especially since this ending is brought about in an extremely artificial way. In the original show, an American film director suddenly appears, declaring that this story would make a good film, but films must have a happy end. Very much a la Beggar's Opera or The Dry Bullshit Holder, which was premiered earlier in 1928. And he therefore instructs the prince and Mary that they must reconcile. The adapters, Wilhelm Busch and Frey, decided to broaden the role of film. In their adaptation, instead of the film director coming in at the end, they found that they reorganized the order of scenes so that the story moves back and forth in time and space, and then they noticed that this was very much like cross-cutting in a film. So with that in mind, this is a quote from Wilhelm Busch, we thought, what a pity, such potential for today's public, very, very attractive, and we considered we can build that in as a red thread through the story, end quote. So they did this by transforming Bondi, making him not only Mary's secretary, but also a budding film director who comes along on the trip to make a movie of the whole story. Romantic irony, the awareness that this is a story being told through art, is created in both versions by this idea of filming the story. That irony undermines the happy ending, giving more power to the cultural criticism. It also opens the door for a particularly delightful scene in the adaptation. In the duet, Rose der Prairie, Mary entices the prince into an imagined America by enacting with him a love scene in which she plays the role of an Indian maiden and he that of a cowboy. The 2004 production inserted animation into this. So Walt Disney's first cartoon with synchronized sound, Steamboat Willie, had been made in 1828, the same year as the original Herzogin production. So this scene refers to America on both levels. I'm going to show the end of the previous scene and the beginning of the duet so you can see the transition.
Sie gefallen mir auch sehr. Musste ich ihnen in ihr übliches Gesicht hineinsagen. Ich möchte gerne sehen, was Sie aus dem alten Rumpelkasten gemacht haben. Würden gerade Sie mit mir eine kleine private Schlossführung machen?
Die größte Vergnügung.
Gnädigst, scheinen Sie überhaupt schon ein bisschen zu akklimatisieren. Man erzählt sich, dass Sie seit einigen Wochen gar nicht im Geheimen meinen Adjutanten empfangen, den Grafen Negrezko.
Und andererseits erzählt man sich, dass Sie täglich eben eine Audienz meinen Jazzdirektor, eine ganze Stunde.
Ihren Jazzdirektor? Ach, ich verstehe. Also bitte, wenn Sie schon wissen, ich lehre Charles.
Nun, und Ihr Graf lernt mich diese schöne Dance, was Sie so lieben, das Vienna Walzer.
Halt, das ist entzückend einerseits und andererseits.
Und andererseits?
Andererseits.
Was ist andererseits, Herr Prinz?
Andererseits wollte ich immer schon den Herrn Prinz zum Teufel jagen und ein Mensch sein, was ich leicht tun muss, um einmal aufzusehen, wie leibhaftiges Glück von der Leben schafft.
Dann geht es Ihnen so wie mir. Wie oft habe ich auch schon Wettbewerbe gewollt, unsere ganzen Milliarden und nichts anderes mehr sein wollen, als meine kleine, bescheidene Millionärin.
Ich wusste gar nicht, dass Ihr Gedächtnis so romantisch veranlagt sind.
Oh, Sie glauben, dass wir in Amerika haben keine Romantik? Noch nie was gehört von die Poesie der Prärie. Kevin Clark has demonstrated, His highly operatic style is notably different from the actual style of the early 20th century, as heard in recordings. Nevertheless, it is dearly beloved. It's demonstrated by comments such as the following in the newspaper Der Standard. The art of sensing innate rhythmic possibilities of this music and realizing them tastefully while maintaining precision cannot be learned by pushing a button. One must simply be born into it. All those involved in this beacon of charmlessness should be urged to make an excursion to the Restaurant Belgrade behind the Naschmarkt, where one can learn by listening to two Hungarian musicians how one plays operetta. I was amused to find an online response to this review, which read, "Music critic Lietza disqualifies himself with a statement about the Belgrade because anyone with the slightest musical education cannot hold out long listening to the live music there. The fiddler may perhaps have Lehár's and Kalman's blood, music in his blood, but his intonation is so unbelievable that it hurts." From my one visit to the Café Belgrade, I'm quite sure that I heard the same violinist. The musicians even asked me to sing Schubert's Ständchen with them, and the experience was quite bizarre. If Wildenbus had been able to, by the way, he would have brought the work even closer to jazz by putting present-day jazz musicians on stage and allowing them to improvise. He had the approval of Yvonne Kalman, the composer's daughter, but the Volksoper management felt that it would have been too expensive and also might have alienated the Vienna audience. When I asked about operetta style, the Volksoper intendant at the time, Rudolf Berger, responded by saying, "First of all, I don't know what correct operetta style is, and I'm sure that if you were to ask one of these critics, he could give you no answer. Those are the cliches and the superficial answers that often come, particularly regarding unfamiliar work." The singers, on the other hand, seemed to believe that there was such a thing as operetta style, but they questioned whether it was appropriate for this work in particular. Noreen Burgess, who played Mary Lloyd, commented that it probably isn't true operetta style, because I suspect he wasn't really writing it as true operetta, because he was consciously making this hybrid. I mean, that's what the story is about. Mirzad Montazeri, who played the prince, summed up the genre issue as follows. "For me, the piece is not just operetta. For me, it is play, it is theater, it is cabaret, cartoons. There is something for everyone in it. There's opera, operetta, musical, and cabaret in it." End quote. Did the critics' hostility to this production reflect the same fear of cultural appropriation expressed by Prince Chandraboris in the show? Perhaps a jazz-tinged operetta was simply too threatening to the Austrian way of life, to quote cabaret singer Roland Neuwirth. But the audience kept coming, and their enthusiasm, despite the critics' horror, leads me to think that the cultural and political landscape of the Volksoper is shifting. Is the audience moving toward a blind acceptance of American imposed taste, or rather toward an appreciation of the value of cultural exchange and fusion? These are questions I hope to explore in further studies of the audience and productions in present-day Vienna. I hope to use this project as the beginning of a larger one on the idea that a changing audience combined with innovative directorship can lead to many fruitful new interpretations.